All right, I think we're ready to go. Bob.
Fantastic. Ruben, how are you, man?
Good, man. How you say it? Nastanovich?
Nastanovich, and yeah, it's just like pretty much exactly the way that it's spelled. So yeah, you did a great your job. You're Ruben Zarate, right?
That's right. That's right.
As opposed to Zarate. But you're from
Yeah.
that too, you know what I mean? That actually has a nice ring to it. Ruben Zarate. Sounds like a box. You have a great boxer name.
I think that was a boxer's name.
Yeah. I mean, you don't strike me as a pugilist yourself.
No, I've never boxed, but
Me neither. That's
yeah.
why I'm so handsome. You know what I mean? That and good clean living, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, I asked a few people on Instagram for questions, and
Yeah. Oh, the guy who let the dog out, he's moaning at me. Mr. Ghost
Oh,
is
okay.
very bossy, so this will actually be helpful.
All right, good.
Dog goes. He does all the
Bob
tricks
is.
in the book, Reuben. Where are you? Do you have a pet yourself?
No, I never pet myself.
Oh, okay. You say you never pet yourself? Or you
Did you
said
ask me?
you don't have a pet yourself?
I thought you asked me if I pet myself, and I said,
No,
no, actually, I
that's
don't.
crass, Ruben. You know, it's a little early. It's only 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, let's kind of keep the crass behavior to a minimum here. You know, like
No, I have a Pomeranian Chihuahua mix. Yeah, cute little dog.
Is that a male or a female?
It's a male. He's about 13 now.
Oh wow!
He's getting up there, but he's sweet.
Yeah,
Yeah.
fantastic.
What
What's his
kind
name?
of dog? Oh, Logan.
Yeah, and that's your best man, huh?
Yeah, he's a good dog. What kind of
Yeah,
dog
and
do you have?
you live in Los Angeles?
Santa Barbara, pretty close.
Yeah, same, yeah. So
Yeah,
how far
same
is that
thing.
from like how is that where you grew up?
Yeah, born and raised.
Yeah, and what's up with Dante? You say it Dante Elefante, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was we couldn't think of a band name, and the original bass player, his girlfriend thought of it. And we're like, shit, that's better than anything else we could think of.
I mean, it works. It's pretty memorable.
Yeah, thanks, man.
And
Yeah.
it's fun, you know, like it kind of like you know, from what I've listened to a handful of songs since you got in touch with me. It kind of fits the vibe of the music, which is just kind of like you know, rock and roll, like just like fun rock and roll, you know.
Yeah,
With like a
totally.
sense of humor, you know, like seems like you guys are having a really good time.
Yeah, it's been really fun. I've been doing it for like 10 years.
And you've
This
done well. You've done not that I don't mean to say that like in a surprised tone, but like I
We're
just
doing
know
okay.
so
Yeah.
I know so many bands that like are really really good that unfortunately don't really get any kind of opportunity. So it's great that you guys. What's the name of your label again?
Don't have one.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you did this,
Exactly.
right?
Lollipop in Los Angeles released our first album. It's always like, per album. I haven't been signed to like a multi record
Yeah,
deal or
never
anything.
signed anything, but I'm saying, you know, we never, like, none of the bands I was in actually ever signed anything, you
Oh,
know.
okay, good.
I mean, actually, after the band ended, you signed stuff, but like, during the thing back then, like, if you had worked with cool people who are your age, and we were very fortunate in that regard with Pavement and Silver Jews and all the record labels that we worked with, they were kind of like-minded people who were sort of starting at the same time. So, like, we're not dealing with like, what you always sort of envision is like this, you know, this rock and roll creep, you know.
Totally.
I mean, obviously, like that's. I mean, maybe we'll talk about that climb. Oh, but actually, you're the one who's conducting the show, so.
Well, we could talk about whatever you want, but I
You
was
know, I like
gonna.
that. I always like to get, you know, because like, I always sort of like to try to make it a point to like kind of get to know who I'm speaking to, and how old are you now?
I'm 30.
Okay, perfect. And like
Yeah.
obviously like I want to ask you this because I put a lot of thought into this. Okay, like
Okay.
I'm 52, I'll be 53 in a few weeks, and I live in Des Moines. So, you know, obviously I live in a place where you know, in a good year like 10 sort of really exciting musical things happen a year, and they, like, you know, sometimes you can't go to all of them, but you know, ideally like 10 nights a year, there's something to do. Now, where in your area, like just like when I lived in New York, you know, I lived in New Jersey and had access to New York and Hoboken, But I mean, there's things going on. Like, you technically could go out like 100 nights a year and see things.
Yeah, if I want to drive to LA, I can do the drive. You know, it's only an hour and a half, so.
Yeah, but I mean, like, yeah. So like, and obviously you guys play. How often does Dante Elefante play out?
Let's see. Pretty often. Like, we did like two national tours last year, and
so you're pretty busy. So like,
yeah,
I'm kind of happy that you did those last year. Was this supposed to be an intermediary year for you guys? Were you gonna like work on new stuff?
No, I was about to. I was about to release stuff.
Okay, so this is what I'm asking you. Like, so like, obviously nothing like this happened during what I'd call like the prime of my life. Like you're going through now.
Yeah.
Okay, so like I just described to you, like I might go out 6-8 times a year to see live music in this town, and then and a handful of road trips, and then usually I find myself at some point being involved in some like 7 to 10 day tour with bands that I've put out on my little label Broker's Tip. And my friend Lucy, who actually lives in LA, Lucy Arnell, I like to go on tour with her. She's a lot of fun. And so, you know, this is the point of my life. I'm not saying it's like the winter of my life, but in terms of like, you know, from like a end of life perspective, like, you know, from like a, in the midst of like, kind of like the, you know, sort of the greatest years of my life as a music fan were like, you know, essentially like 15 to 35, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, obviously when I was 33, when Pavement ended, and then, you know, I'd spent a lot of time doing that. I just kind of want to do something else, but like, you know, it's right in the middle of like, you know, really like, you know, your band's been around for 10 years.
Yeah.
You love live music. You love to listen to records. Yeah. Like, you know, live music is an irreplaceable thing. Like, you know, you can't, you know, you can watch sports on TV, or you can.
Well, now, yeah, now we
watch
can.
Movies on TV. You don't have to go to a movie theater. I mean, like, all of those things can be, I mean, obviously, like, we'd all rather see it on the big screen, but like at this day and age, like movies, TV, sports, everything can actually fit like a quarantine type situation. Obviously reading, there's a lot, just about every form of entertainment that we indulge in, we can essentially do at home, with the exception of live music. I don't think that can be recreated during a pandemic. And it causes me great concern that like, I've got two really cool nephews that are 25 and 21. So just like you, like, this is like a year out of your lives that you'll never get back.
Oh, yeah.
You're supposed to be going out seeing, like, discovering new things, seeing old favorites, you know, seeing your friends' bands play, like, you know, going to see, like, maybe your three favorite bands since you were, like, a kid that might be coming through LA at some point.
Totally. Just,
like, so I kind of feel your pain. So, like, we're – I mean, actually, like, I was actually planning on going to, like, the main music event here in Iowa every year. It's this pretty cool festival that we have over in Iowa City called Mission Creek. And there's usually, like, three or four really cool acts from around the world that play that. Like, unfortunately, that was one of the first things to get pulled. And, you know, but generally, like, it's just – I just wanted to ask you, like, how difficult has that been for you? Like, have you turned sort of more inward to your own art? Or, like have you really missed – in addition to doing your own touring, playing your own gigs, like just all the nights that you won't have.
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely something I've thought about. Like, I think I spent like all of March kind of like, who knows what's going to happen? I'm just going to chill at home. And then after March happened, I was like, okay, this might be going on a little longer. So time to start writing again. Like, what am I doing? What can we start doing to keep pushing the message of this band? Like, maybe I should focus on merch. We can get some, like, get the store going to try and generate
some revenue.
Yeah, you pretty
much are, like, responsible for your own income at Dante Elefante, though.
Totally, yeah. And, you know, I own 100% of my streams, so I at least get my streaming money, which is fine, you know?
Yeah, like, and I don't, you know, I usually don't check anybody's streaming numbers, but, like, so would you say, like, in a good year, like, Dante Elefante makes, like, maybe $5,000 off of streaming?
Yeah.
That's like a fair estimate.
Yeah.
Okay. So anywhere between like $3,000 and $8,000. Like, obviously, if you put out a new album that was like, you know, had a little bit of buzz around it, like those numbers would go up and stuff like that. So it is something. It does pay for like your van and like your maybe a little bit of recording and like, you know, gear repair. And you put your stuff on everything: Spotify, Bandcamp, Apple Music,
TikTok.
Yeah. Whatever. I mean, like, you know, the thing is, like,
it works. Yeah.
You know, people ask me about, you know, this kind of thing, this whole streaming thing, and it's just never really something that I've ever had to think about, because I was never actively involved in bands during this streaming era. So obviously, like, you know, payment stuff gets, that's all just like label things. It's all even over my head. I don't really even know if there's nothing on my pay statements when I get royalty statements that I can delineate how much money that I personally am making off of streaming. And of course, Drag City refused to participate in any of that until the last, if I had to guess, like maybe 2 or 3 years. Has all their stuff been available on Spotify and everything else? So, like, I guess I come from this sort of like really traditionalist background, and I do hear a lot of artists my age that are, you know, still going. I'm good friends with Janet Weiss from Quasi and formerly of Sleater Kinney, and like she complains quite a bit about the streaming. Like, a lot of people, I read a thing the other day from that woman Nico K, so I don't know, like,
oh yeah,
bitching about streaming and stuff. And it's just one of those things that I just don't, you know, that I don't, I mean, obviously the label that I put out 507 inches by maybe 3 or 4 bands a year, and I try to sell them from my living room, and it's entirely nonprofit. And once I've retrieved the money then that I put out, it usually costs like, you know, $1,300 or $1,400 with shipping. You have 507 inches made, then all the money goes. So if I sell like 250 records and like the last, you know, 250, like all the money goes to the bands, because I don't want a cent, you know, like,
yeah.
I'm happy to do the work, you know. So, and so it's a very basic philosophy. Like, normally, like, the old school way to do it would be to split that money 50-50. But, like, at this point, I don't want to do that, because so many bands, like your band, you know, I feel like they're kind of getting, like, sort of screwed in a sense. Like, your main – it's probably really hard to sell your product and your merch, especially when you can't tour. That's got to affect your sales by, like, 80-90%. And – I remember I've toured with several artists, including Max Solish, who's kind of defunct now, but he had this wonderful band called Dollfish, D-O-L-F-I-S-H. And he told me that like 75% of the money he made was like selling merch and records after shows. Is that still sort of the same way?
Yeah, I would say so. We sold out of all of our, you know, shirts and merch on the road midway through a large tour last year, direct support opening for someone else. And
good.
That was awesome. But then, you know, trying to get all of our merch back together and try to get the store up and running again has been tough, because it's like, where is this money going to come from to manufacture these things? And a little worried about that. But really, I think in today's,
I'll share some tips with you. I've gotten some pretty good deals recently. Like, I just got, I make things in very small quantities, like these hats like this. I'm like, you know, 10 or 15 different colors, and they're decent. Like, they're those like
Nice
caps. Like I get these for about $10 with all the printing and stuff on them. And, but I found a really good deal. I'm just doing t-shirts for the first time here at Broker's Tip. And like, I got a really incredible deal on t-shirts, and they're good. They're good brands too, like Gildan, Super Soft, and Delta Apparel and stuff like that. So I'm kind of pleased with the deal. I kind of find deals with that kind of stuff. So I'll give you some, once we get off, I'll clue you in.
Wait, Bob,
maybe
can't hear you.
Maybe
now.
You say, oh, I can do better than that, because you do it more often. But like,
yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, like, so when your band plays in, let's just say hypothetically, Portland, and how many people do you play for there? Like,
Headlining, we sold out Bunk Bar. So what is that, like 200?
I was just there in January.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah, I did I was part of like a lengthy, Gail O'Hara put it on. It was like a tribute to David Berman.
Oh, that's right.
On his birthday. And it was a Bunk Bar. And I'm actually happy that normally I would not be able to reference any West Coast venue, but I know it, I know it very well, because I spent 7 hours in there. And I thought the staff was lovely and the sandwiches were good.
Oh, the sandwiches
were
good.
And I thought
it
sounded great. So you sell that out.
Yeah, we sold that out last time we played there. And then
are you still there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah. You sell out Bunk Bar.
Yeah, we did that last time, and I think I played Aladdin or something. when I was doing the direct support tour, that was like at a theater.
And you make you know, decent money when you tour too now, right? Like,
yeah, pretty much. Like, you know, I'm able to pay the band and
Four people in the band?
Yeah, it's about drums, bass, guitars, and keys. So there's like maybe four or five, depending if I can get a key player or not.
And you just do it in one band, you jam a Kano.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yes, but if you're making like, you know, whatever, 1,000, 2,000 a night, playing like, you know, 15 shows, then you guys come home with a profit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're some, doing good. Some tours it hasn't been that way. But things leading up to the last 2 years were kind of picking up. We did South By, we did all these things. We, you know, we're very DIY, we're doing it ourselves here, but like,
oh, you booked your own stuff too.
I booked one tour, and then that led me to work with a big agency, but now I'm not on that agency anymore because my agent got promoted, so there you go.
Oh, yeah, that just sounds so typical.
He does classic rock now, and I'm not.
Yeah, those guys must be really, like, freaking out because, like, they work hard, but at the same time, they usually make pretty serious bank, and, like, it's a pretty fun gig to have, especially if you're well-established.
Yeah.
They're also... you know, they're having bad years. I wonder what's your take on, like, obviously the gray area of using the words this time next year really sort of don't have meaning in this country at this point, because it could be, God forbid, it could be worse. So let's just say when Ruben's like 33, it's got to be sort of somewhat back to something that you would, some semblance of what it was in 2019 and before.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, it's my biggest, wait that long.
Hopefully not. But my biggest fear is, or my biggest concern is just trying to keep that momentum and maybe even getting away from the album, which I think is right up your alley because you release singles.
Yeah.
So singles, it's like, great. Just putting out singles, maybe start featuring with other indie bands, which isn't like a thing right now. It's like, it's so big in hip hop to have like so-and-so on this track. And now you're both cross promotion and it's helping both of your brands.
Oh, really? You thought about that kind of stuff. Interesting.
Oh yeah. I think that could be very big if we end up all inside the house for another 6 months. Maybe even another year.
Oh, cool. I'm happy you have your finger on the pulse. And your bandmates, do they live close by?
I know my bass player lives really close, and I think our drummer's in LA, and then the lead guitar player is in Lompoc. So yeah, basically,
it's okay, all still. But like collaboration, have you been able to do that this year, like via the internet or anything else, or like are you the chief songwriter?
Yeah,
I guess you're like the Stephen Malkmus of Dante.
Yeah, I guess so. That's a big compliment.
Well, no, because I said of Dante Elefante.
Yeah, totally, totally.
I met
Steven once in Santa Barbara.
He's nice.
Yeah, I thought so too. We bumped into
him perfectly.
What happened?
I can imitate him perfectly.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do it for you. I'd be like, yeah, I saw you guys, like Dante Elefante. It's a cute name. I just thought it was cool. Like, I mean, it's poppy and everything, but like, nice rock. Like, you seem like you're having a really good time and stuff. So, I mean, I'm not going to like crab it or anything like that. I would say keep doing what you're doing. And like, I mean, you never know what these kids are going to like. So weird here. But like, anyways, do you know where I can get like kind of, I'm not like starving, but like anywhere I can get like walking distance, like a halfway decent burrito, like something like that, or, you know. Anyways, the record shop's over there, pretty cool. Like,
yeah, I bumped into him at the bathroom at his show, and we locked eyes, and I was like, "I'm excited for your set," and he was like, "Oh, thanks." Yeah,
was that a Jix or a Stephen Malkmus?
It was a Jix show, and he was like, "I'm excited to see you too," and I was like, "Okay," and he was like, "You know what I mean," and he like walked away. I was like, "All right, yeah, that was awesome."
I'll take it. That sounds like brevity, because like, you know, the people like I can understand like guys like that. I mean, I was the same way with like, you know, a lot of people. Well, I always just thought my attitude when I was like younger than you, and then even your age, you know, I lived in, you know, Richmond, which was always had great music scene, and Charlottesville had a surprisingly good one. Thanks to this one booking agent, Maynard Sipe in Charlottesville, you got a lot of great things there. And then of course, living right next to Maxwell's and Hoboken and all the venues in New York for years. And then I moved to Louisville. So I've always kind of been in pretty vibrant music scenes. And so I've had the pleasure of seeing hundreds of my favorite bands, which has been sort of a great gift of my life. And
yeah.
And, you know, before I was even in bands, and of course you play with a lot of really great bands and stuff like that. So, but I would always be, I wasn't the kind of guy that wanted to take up too much of their time. My general line would just always be like to go up to them, you know, and say, thanks a lot for coming, you know, to Charlottesville, or, you know, thanks for coming.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it really means a lot to like me and my friends that you guys have come here. And then like, kind of like, and so you know, like, you'd have to be dealing with a real asshole if they were a jerk to you after that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because the last thing you wanted to find out was that a band that you love, like, that they were a bunch of jerks, you know? Because then it would affect the way you listen to their music, you know?
Yeah.
That ruined a few bands for me, but I'm not going to name names.
You don't have to name any names, but every time I tell someone that story about meeting Steven, they always get like tense and they're like, oh, was he nice? I heard he could be, I was like, he was cool to me. He didn't, you know, we talked for 5 seconds. Like, and
I mean,
I wonder,
generally speaking with him, he would sort of, even if he was in a horrible mood,
yeah,
he would never take it out on a stranger.
Totally.
And he thinks he was far more horrible than he actually was. I mean, you know, touring, like, you know, you've toured in arduous situations, and
sometimes you have rough days, you know?
Yeah, I mean, off days, you're irritated, you're not, I mean, obviously you're not sleeping enough, your eating habits are right. I mean, the thing is, like, obviously, I don't want to complain about it because it's a glorious way to go through your 20s and 30s and beyond. And, you know, I miss those days, like, you know, sort of like not being in the lap of luxury and like doing it like in a really, really budgeted manner to try to make as much money as possible.
Totally.
This is sort of like the pre-tour bus era pavement. And no matter where we were in the world, we sort of did everything on the cheap because, you know, because there's five of us and we wanted to make money. So, and you know, you're together a lot and, you know, every venue is a different experience, especially like if you've never been to them, and just the whole vibe, like, you know, the crowd. I mean, depend on so many issues. Like, there's there's definitely tough times when you feel kind of miserable, but at the same time, it's obviously glorious. And then I remember Mark Eibold, especially, he loved touring for the most part, and he would always get what he called post-tour depression, where you're sort of like back up, like the action sort of stops, and you're sort of like off the road. And then, like, for me, I never really experienced that because I would just sort of jump back into some other aspect of my life, you know, like that entertained me or something like that. And I mean, the only thing is that I remember, like, after the band stopped in 99, and that it would, like, going to see bands for the first several years, like having that feeling, even if the band was outstanding, that having this sort of weird feeling, like it would be fun to be up there, you know, be fun to be up there again, because, like, you know, on you just, and as corny as it may sound, I've said this several times, corny is a very corny thing to say, but you miss the applause, because, like, you know, like, and that's something that people should never underestimate, no matter who they are, whether they're great opera singers or athletes or even like indie rock bands that play for 80 people or 400 people, is that, like, there's not many things that most people get to do in their lives where there's enthusiastic people who like their art out there applauding and cheering you on. And like in Pavement's case, since we were, especially in the early years, pretty erratic live, like actually cheering us on to do well, knowing that they could sort of like help a band that in a lot of cases was under practiced and unprepared, and in some cases inconsistent and underconfident musicians, when I refer to myself, because I never took the stage with too much confidence, because I was never meant to play music, really. I was sort of meant to be a roadie and a tour manager and all these other things. And then it became sort of clear to me right off the bat that that I should sort of participate. But I never, and I remember like being on tour with like, you know, members of like Stereolab and bands like that had like classically trained musicians. And, you know, this band we toured with called the High Llamas, they had this one guy, Dominic, that was one of like the best vibraphonists like in the world, you know, just, which is the instrument that if I could really choose one that I knew how to play, and like, I'd love to be able to play that well. But I never trained, was never trained in any way, shape, or form in music. And like people say, oh, you're in a band, like, you know, we should jam sometime. And, and I said, I can't. The only music I know how to play is like the Pavement and Silver Jew songs that I played on and a few other things. I mean, like I can't really do much more than keep time, which I think is sort of advantageous in some regards. I think there's a lot of drummers that hit the drums too often.
Did you ever find that intimidating? Did Pavement or Silver Jews ever want to be that like super tight polished rock band?
I mean, I'm sure that like, you know, that's, you know, you get two different answers. Maybe five in that case. Yeah. I think if you talk to Steve West, he put an incredible amount of work into it. Yeah. So he did not want to get criticized. He wanted to be on the ball, and he's still very much a fun loving guy. Then Gary, in his case, Gary Young, the first drummer for Pavement.
Yeah.
He was a really good drummer, and he was just, all he cared about was entertainment. So like the music was like equal to the entertainment. He was just a real showman, an alcohol fueled showman, which there was a lot more of back then, and like the era of rock in which he played, 70s, 80s, and 90s, like, yeah, I'm sure like in your generation there's, you know, a fair amount of incoherence among the other artists, but like it doesn't seem like it's as like in the 80s and 90s there were just so many bands, even like famous bands, that were like notoriously out of their minds, like obviously the Replacements come to mind, and Butthole Surfers and you know, Jesus Lizard and Scratch Acid. I mean, like, you got like one of my biggest rock and roll heroes who actually lives in LA is David Yao from Scratch Acid and Jesus Lizard. And he's, you know, he's a wild showman, you know, like it seems like your generation of bands are, there's more of a concentration on like the music and sort of precision and like, sort of getting it right, and like you maybe will have one or two beers during the show or something.
Totally. You
know? Whereas people like back then were, in a lot of cases, whether it was alcohol or something else, were generally could be out of their minds. I mean, obviously guided by Voice, another band that obviously put away a lot of brewskis.
I think because my generation came after your guys's, that we saw you guys and how the other bands operated and maybe how they treated us when we were coming up, and they're, you know, kind of drunk, and we're like, oh shit, I looked at that and I was like, I don't really want to be like that. Like the local bands, I guess I should say, the local bands that like let my high school band open for them. And
right.
You know, yeah. And they're kind of assholes and dicks, and they didn't really go anywhere. They never really left Santa Barbara. So
they were kind of like these guys that thought they were rock and roll, but they were just kind of loser alcoholics.
Totally. Like right when MySpace was just starting. So you still were like
MySpace
in your
starting. Yeah, MySpace. More like I skipped MySpace. My wife is she was on MySpace, but then I just missed MySpace, and I do the social media now on like a totally public platform. But like, so basically, I mean, not obvious, but I mean, like, we were nice. I mean, the bands
totally.
The bands were nice people. It's just that there was just more chaos involved, and there was more unpredictability, and you know, even like sort of far out and interesting bands that I do see, it seems like there's a certain, like you'd see like a band like Sun City Girls, you didn't really know who they are, you know, in the 80s, you didn't know who they were, because they were like, I saw them play one gig with like, they were all wearing burlap sacks with like X's painted on them and stuff. And there was a lot of really like, there was a lot of performance art and music being played at the same time. Like things seem like, when I do see a really good band from your generation, it seems that it's that they're just like really have practiced a lot and they're really on the ball, and they the music seems like a priority, and it's nice to see a combination act where like it's not like an artist, say for example, like Mitski or something like that.
Yeah.
She just kind of stands up there and plays. Whereas then you see a performer like Cherry Glazer, she puts on a show.
She's great.
She's a proper rock and roll showwoman, you know, like, and that's a huge part of the entertainment. You know, she sort of has like a bit of a kick-ass element. And I'm not saying like one's better than the other.
Totally.
Obviously they do pretty far different forms of music. I do think it's been kind of good over the last several years in indie rock that, in fact, I remember like it was just at a time about a decade ago where I thought there was a sort of like void in like women taking the helm and being sort of powerful in indie rock. And I feel like they've kind of like, just like in, sort of ironically in horse racing, that the female horses and the female bands have been quite excellent in a lot of ways compared to their male counterparts. And I'm not dissing Dante Elefante by any means, but it does seem like coming after a time, like, you know, whether it be like Courtney Barnett or hundreds. I mean, like, essentially I find myself on my label generally putting out bands that are maybe not entirely female, but seemingly female led.
Totally.
So I think that that's sort of encouraging, and in light of the,
well, I haven't gotten tours because I'm a band full of all dudes, quotes.
Really? So that does affect your business?
Yeah, it's which is fine. Like, that's what they can do, you know?
Kick the biggest asshole out and replace him with a cool girl, dude.
I'm seconds away from doing that. Yeah, after this year.
I'm just kidding, man.
But yeah, that's like something you have to definitely think about now. And I think it's good. I think there needs
to be more.
The other
thing that's freaky to me is that there's this one band that I put out their record. They're a fantastic band from Richmond, Virginia, called Piranorama.
Cool.
And really good live, but like they play, they're kind of big in Richmond. Have you guys played in Richmond? Have you made it to Richmond yet?
Yeah, we played the Broadberry in Richmond.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely, yeah. And you drew some people in there?
We opened, yeah.
Oh, cool. So, yeah. Richmond's a great rock and roll town. And so Piranorama's, you know, they're the kind of band that they play, they're kind of regional, but when they play, you know, 6, 8, 10 shows in Richmond a year, they draw, you know, a few hundred people, you know, and if it's a bigger deal, it's a bigger deal.
Yeah.
So they're kind of big in Richmond for what it's worth. And, like, I've been trying to hook them up. They've been trying to find a booking agent for a few years now because they'd like to do, you know, proper touring in at least the eastern half of the country. And the big nag on them, the big negative is that there's too many of them. If you ever heard, you know, there's that too. So like you're saying that like there's all these like, you know, booking agents that are from my era that are like, you know, in their 50s that I knew back then that I've been in touch with. I was like, oh, this guy, like, you know, I know him personally, like maybe like, you know, you never really expect anybody in this industry to do you a favor.
Yeah.
And that's a huge generalization.
That's something you kind of learn, though. Like, you think, I'm going to play this show for this guy, and then he'll get me back. And then they don't.
Yeah, I mean, that never really happens. I mean, even, like, you know, Pavement had sort of a glorious run where we had that whole, like, kind of critics darlings thing. We sort of always sort of maintained that, but, like, during like the Wowie Zowie era and the Bright in the Corners era, there was sort of this backlash. We went from being like this band for a handful of years that critics adored. So it was like kind of like a cyclical thing where it was like kind of like the cool thing for journalists to do was like diss the Pavement record. So even though like we thought the records were as good, it actually went so far as that you'd go see these semi-reputable music journalists at various concerts and festivals, and they would act like they didn't know you, whereas like 2 or 3 or 4 years before they were like essentially kissing your ass. And that was an unusual phenomenon. I found out like how insincere so many of them were, because I thought that you feel like you established like a rapport with them, like whether they you know, like your music or not. And I'm not talking just like one or two. I'm talking about, you know, several, like in all parts of the world, UK and here in particular. So it is sort of interesting the way that that works. But again, like Pavement was so fortunate. I mean, everything sort of fell into place. The music was so 90s. And like,
yep.
There's a certain amount of like void in, you know, in making music like ours with like our particular set of, you know, a few dozen influences, like kind of like, just like all music, kind of like twisting it into your own thing off of your, you know, essentially like 20 to 30 to 40 favorite things that have effect on your songwriting. And I've never, that's another major difference between you and me, Ruben, is that you're a songwriter. And like,
yeah. So
during this COVID-19 era, have you been able to, I don't know, what's your process? Do you write the tune first and the lyrics second, or is it a simultaneous thing?
If I get the chords going and I can get a little melody going, okay, then that's something. Either that's going to be the verse or it's probably going to be the verse. I usually start with the verses first. And then I'll do like a loop on the iPad on GarageBand.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's useful. That's like a very basic and useful tool, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just plug the keyboard in and just kind of get something going. And then build it out. Yeah, I'll usually spend like 8 hours. And then 8 hours goes by and you're like, oh, damn, I think I got something. I ignored everyone in my life.
But then when you really feel like you have something great, like especially with those guys. Like, so like Malkmus, I'm sure, did the same thing. Of course, Malkmus had to do more. He had to like he actually had to kind of like think of like the bass part and the drum part and all that kind of stuff. Because his bandmates were in other parts of the country. Then we're essentially like, just like the interesting thing about Silver Jews is that the early era of Silver Jews, at least, and I think it pretty much continued all the way through, is David's the only artist I've ever worked with where he's a poet first and a musician second. And so the music was built around the lyrics. The lyrics came first. So you play with him and you just get handed maybe 15 poems or sets of lyrics, and you'd sort of read the poem and like kind of, it's a good thing Malkmus was in the band back then because he's so good.
Yeah.
And then all I did was really keep time, but with a few other contributions and background vocals and keyboard noises and stuff. But like, it was fun to build things just around really formidable words. And you know, Pavement was more sort of like what you're actually doing in COVID-19. So you're like, you're the main tunesmith. And like, eventually at some point when you guys are able to get together on a more consistent basis, you're going to have to ideally bring 10, 15, 20 song ideas to the table for the next Dante.
And then I'll trim it down.
right.
Yeah. Usually around like 9 to 10, 11-ish.
Yeah. Well, shoot for the moon, you know. I mean, like, you know, you've got, now do you have a day job?
I was DJing.
Oh, like, no way.
Wedding,
like,
weddings at bars. No, like weddings, bars, and I do just all vinyl, and yeah.
Oh, so nuts. Yeah, that's what I do too.
But oh, really? Cool.
Yeah, and I do like one DJ night a month. Des Moines, you know, keep that in mind. Like, I do a DJ night a month, and then I would say throughout the course of the year, whether it be, I'd say I probably do like maybe 15 to 20 nights in Des Moines, and then maybe 15 to 20 in other places. Like, I'll go on tour with bands that I put out on Broker's Tip, and I'll play records before, after, and during their sets. Like, you know, I mean, like, ideally, a lot of clubs would be nice if they had like, I don't understand this.
Yeah,
stuff.
Tables.
Music these days. How come more venues don't have like a booth with like two turntables in it?
I know.
It's not that expensive.
And like and the ones I have, it's like they're always so shaky. And like,
yeah, no,
the bass is like rumbling, and you're like,
"Oh, bring your own decks." So you bring your own decks, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
What do you have? I just have those $250 like standard Audio Technica things.
I have I have one Technics S, or, you know, 210s, 1200s,
like a fancy one. I have one of those. It's really old. I would never. Yeah. That's too important.
I got it at Amoeba for like $300, and
that was smart shopping.
Awesome. Yeah. And then a Neumark that we like, I have another, like a cheaper one.
But that's just so. Like, that's like those Audio Technica things. Like, if you're ever,
I was looking at those at first.
Yeah. Mine are great. They're the best, like, they're the best, like $225.
Totally.
Yeah, they're good. And you can they get thrashed, but they keep on fighting, you know?
That's awesome.
So you actually can do it. You can sort of like scratch out a living between Dante Elefante and doing maybe 50 DJ sets a year.
Yeah, and hopefully I try to get one wedding every month, or maybe a wedding every 3 months. Like that could.
Yeah, because wedding means over $1,000, right?
Easy, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, especially in Santa Barbara, where it's wedding season all year round. Well, it was. but yeah.
So are you sort of like, now do you must play, you can't play like, you must play a lot of music that generally isn't your favorite then, like.
Oh, that's when it becomes a job.
Yeah, when you've got to play like all the crap they want you to play and like.
Yes.
I mean, you've never lowered yourself to playing like, you know, like you've never lowered yourself to playing things like White Snake and
no, it's usually just Cherry like the
Red.
New hit.
You ever find yourself spinning Cherry Red by Warrant? or Cherry Pie? No, Cherry Pie. I'm sorry. Cherry.
Yeah. I've been fortunate not to spin any of the 80s.
You ever have to like dip in the Don't Stop Believing?
Oh, I've played Don't Stop Believing. Yeah, people. That's what they walked out to. One couple. They walked out of their wedding to that song because Don't Stop Believing on their marriage.
And then you know? All you can hope for as the DJ is that. While you're playing Don't Stop Believing is that they never breed.
That's seriously. Yeah. But not a lot of 80s hair metal. A lot of modern hip hop, which I'm not great on. So usually
like
either.
I mean, I know like I've got my favorite stuff like that, but like
Always just doing. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much of it. It's amazing. You know, it's just something that like, you know, I feel like I buy, maybe one or two things a year. There's so much there's so much great hip hop that I missed out on.
Deep
and like reggae and dub and like I guess I do a podcast myself, but it's just an audio.
That's right. I listened to it today.
Oh yeah, and we've done like 124 episodes. The last one I wouldn't listen to because it was a tough day. I just don't make any sense, really.
I listened to it. I wasn't sure if you had a couple beers and were chilling and.
I had a couple beers.
Yeah.
It's one of those situations where I should have called it off, but then I didn't want to disappoint the guy. And like, you know, we only have the way our schedules align. Like, it's only like 3 or 4 times a month. And like, I was sort of, I was in the sauce.
Yeah, me and my cousin re-recorded a podcast like that, and I listened back to it the next morning, and I was like, nope, I'm not putting this out.
Well, see, I'm not in charge. And like, my wife, she was like, he shouldn't put that up. But it's just like, I just document it. I don't really care, you know?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. I like that you guys put it on SoundCloud.
One of my friends told me in a very kindly way that she thought that I sounded over-refreshed.
Oh, okay. That's a nice way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
but I do like that you guys put it on SoundCloud and you guys can put like,
the next
you
time
know.
Like somebody has to like bring you home, Ruben, when you're falling down drunk and like they call you and be like, and you're like, oh man, I'm so sorry. Like I was so wasted and just say, no, you're fine, Ruben. You know, you're just over refreshed. You're good.
I think the culture has changed like in like live shows where, you know, with a lot of the Me Too stuff happening, like we can't get too drunk at these shows and you have to, I'm constantly checking my bandmates like, hey, like before a tour, I even told them like, no fucking around on this tour. Like we're here to play the show, get paid, make some fans and leave, which is maybe not something that happened in the past. Oh, it definitely hasn't happened in the past, but.
Well, I mean, see, everything I was a part of that was, I mean, at least from the band perspective was something that I never really had to worry about. And it was sort of interesting to me, like that you'd sort of encounter bands that I think that's just the way it is sort of like in every walk of life is that some people are in a band or they play sports with sort of the intent of getting laid.
Yeah.
And I guess it's always been a part of rock and roll, but like from my experience in the 90s, it was particularly, and keep in mind, like when I was in my college years was during the AIDS era. And so So like when I was in my, you know, 18 to 25, like the fear of AIDS was very big part of our upbringing. So that kind of like freewheel in the 90s in particular, I can only speak for Pavement.
Yes.
And I can actually speak for some of the other bands that we toured with that I never really saw or too much of that behavior. Although I'm sure that it went on and then, but not in my own world. Cause like the guys that I was in bands with, you never even had to have any, nobody would ever misbehave in that regard.
Yeah.
It was like the reason why you did it, the reason why you were in a band, the priority was to make cool music.
Yeah.
And feel like you were doing something kind of important and it was sort of exciting. So just, and you know, and beer and whatever was just like, I mean, like that was just never a concern with us. I mean, like any of us. And then, you know, of course, like, I think if really sort of analyzed my role in Pavement, I think really that I appealed more to the drunken men in the audience than any women.
Yeah.
So that it was always interesting. Like I was so always on the other side of the stage with Malkmus. You look out on the crowd and it was all like kind of dudes like me in front of me.
Totally.
And Camberg, the other Spiral Stairs, the other guitar player. And Malkmus, like all the pretty girls were over in front of him. For fairly obvious reasons.
Yeah. And, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I know that some bands, especially like sort of like in the 80s.
For sure.
And I mean, I know some of the bands that I would always cross pathways on tour that like, I mean, I know like Urge Overkill. You ever hear that band?
Yeah.
Three-piece band that was on Touch and Go, like we often somehow would always be on tour with them at the same time. They'd always kind of play similar type venues, especially in the UK and Europe, and so they'd be like a day ahead of us or a day behind us. Like so they'd always be in the same, a lot of cases, same very small hotel with us, and you know we'd come home at the same time, and they'd come home with the ladies because that was a priority to them, and we would just come home like just over lagered it doesn't blow my mind. It just seems like it's a thing. I was disheartened and disappointed by reading what I read about the Burger Records guys.
Totally.
Because I don't know them, of course, and like I'm mostly unaware of their catalog. Aside from a few things, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I never really knew much about the guys. I found more out about the actual guys that run it last week than you know, how long have they been around? Like 10 years? Like
10 years, yeah.
Okay, so it seemed to me like, judging by the interviews I read of them before there was any problem, that one thing that I found immediately disconcerting was their overwhelming adoration of Iggy Pop, who I know is a huge rock and roll hero to generations of punk fans and stuff. And he's never really made much appeal to me. This is whole style. And like, even though like Mike Watt, like he's a hero of mine, toured with him and stuff, played bass with him for several years.
Oh, cool.
And I mean, but Iggy Pop was just like one of these guys that just is like, to me, like just kind of creepy in a bad way. And like, obviously never knew him personally. He's a completely different level of legend and stuff like that. And, but I was never really interested in him. And like, I've always found that like, it just seemed to me like this is like, and I'm being very basic and I don't really know these people. It's sort of unfair. I don't even know to what extent I don't know all the details. I just read basically Lucy Arnell told me, you know, that this was going on. So I spent, you know, an hour or two doing some research. But like reading the articles, they just seem like these kind of nerdy guys that like got into like being a record label and being a record store. And like they're like kind of a one in a million, like kind of lucky, like things fell into place for them. And they got to work with a lot of really talented artists and things happen fast. And they kind of went from being like just these like nerds who thought they were cool because they like punk and other stuff to being like sort of like indie celebrities. Mm-hmm. And they, I mean, you know, maybe it's one of these things where like they just saw an opportunity to take advantage of their overnight stardom in this sort of like ultra hipster Southern California music scene situation. And unfortunately, that resulted in some very, very horrible behavior. Horrible behavior.
Totally.
I mean, I don't know all the details, but from what I've heard, and you know, there's lots of indie rock bands, it seems like, from the last 10, 15 years that have gotten in trouble. And then like, you know, somebody like who came before them in the 90s and in a lot of cases, Pavement in particular is often cited as an influence by a lot of these bands. And one thing that is unquestionably clear to me is that if we influence them, we only influence them musically. We certainly did not influence them from a behavioral standpoint.
From like culture and behavior, yeah.
Leadership standpoint, or just being like, just good, like just normal people who are like nice. I think that was one of sort of the keys to Pavement, is that just that kind of unassuming, like nice, kind of like just not being a dickhead or a lunkhead. Yeah. Or not like thinking that you're really cool because you're in a band.
It was really about the art and about, you know,
I never really cared about like, I mean, it was fun to be in a band. It was an exciting thing. And it was like, it was amazing to get sort of, you know, unexpected recognition in a similar fashion to like anybody who has, and including your band, you know, the fact that yeah. you're, you know, playing sold out gigs at small venues around the country and opening for bands playing bigger gigs. It's like, you know, you just consider yourself incredibly fortunate, and
yeah,
and there's a certain amount of responsibility that comes with that you don't take that threshold and then screw it up and then in a horrible and disgraceful manner ruin the lives of young people who like your music. I mean, that's just totally. like why would you hurt your fans? I mean, without yeah. your fans, like, I mean, Your fans are the ones that, especially in your case,
are literally my life blood.
Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, like, you know, don't bite the hands that feed you. Don't lick the hand that feeds you. I mean, like,
yeah, totally.
It's just like, it's just disappointing. Cause like, I'd hate to think that people would be like, oh yeah, I'm sure they did that stuff too back then. You know, like,
yeah.
So it's like, whereas a band like Yola Tango would be sort of safe, you know, like, you know, our bands like a similar band to yours, like an all dude band like Pavement, they're probably like, well, God knows what they did, you know?
Yep.
Well, not, and, nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of my like friends from horse racing, which is a totally different world that is far more misogynist than music ever was. Mm. Always like some people like actually, they sort of have this idea that whatever I was doing in the 90s is a so-called, like, they think I was a rock star. They don't really realize I'm an indie rock star.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that I was in a successful indie rock band or whatever. They don't understand the difference, okay? And like, yeah. So they think that, like, I have this crazy whirlwind time in the 90s that was all sex, drugs, and rock and roll, like Led Zepp or, like, you know, something like that. When in reality, it was mostly just beer and live shows and
totally.
Recording sessions. So like, not, and believe me, we had a great time.
Totally.
Like, I think it's just like, I just can't believe that people would take, seize the opportunity of being in a band to be a pervert, but perhaps like that they just would have been that way no matter what walk of life that they ended up in. So if they had been like really successful car dealers,
they would have been the same person.
Same thing. Or if they'd been like, you know, successfully running like a marijuana dispensary or something like that. So it's just like, who knows? I mean, like, I just feel terrible for all the artists and all the fans that have supported this label and really made these guys sort of successful. And I'm not, I'm not a lawyer, you know, the whole like innocent till proven guilty thing. And like, I will say that the initial ideas they came out with of like quickly wanting to turn it into like this all girl run label, that was like some sort of like almost like marijuana induced pipe dream that they were going to be able to set themselves by like overnight turning themselves into a girl power outfit sort of off as particularly lame and low. So obviously when they're the kind of guys that I would call them front runners, when everything's going their way, they handle things pretty well. But when like all of a sudden the chips are not only down but really seriously down, they panic and start exposing themselves as horrible decision makers.
Yeah.
When what they should have done is just immediately fold up their tent and just go away. And hope that if they do face criminal charges at some point, that their record sort of gets them out of doing serious time. But again, I don't know all the details.
Totally.
To me, it's just very, very disheartening and disappointing that somebody would take their threshold within something like indie rock and sort of like a miracle string of events working out and all kinds of artists, women and men sort of trusting them with their art, and then and the whole time like doing horrible things.
Yeah, that's well, okay, so to touch on something you said about like the 90s, I feel like the 90s were the last, I always say this, the 90s were like the last great decade, especially for music and like big budgets, like tour support, like they could give you money to rent the van and stuff like that. All that's like completely gone.
Right. Yeah, we never. Yeah, I mean, I
did
remember.
Did you guys feel that even on the indie level that there was just more money, like labels could give you to tour? And
no, I mean, the only time that I ever really ever saw, you know, I mean, the 2010 was completely different. But then, you know, then there's no way to really compare because 2010 was just a sort of like a lot of bands do. They get back together and they made. Like Slint of all bands, a band like Slint, who essentially like a secretive organization, and they were the last band that I ever thought would like do a reunion tour. But then they not only did they do a reunion tour, but then they kind of like sort of carried on with more. And like in Pavement's case, our when Steven sort of consented to doing the reunion tour in 2010, it was obviously it was just like a one off. You know, we weren't going to like start being a band again because it was lucrative. It was just like. There's a certain amount of demand for people that never really had a chance to see Pavement to see us essentially do like, you know, 25 to 30 more recognizable Pavement songs. And it was a lot of fun. And
I saw you guys at the Hollywood like, Bowl.
Because all of our deals were so straightforward. We had the same booking agent sort of started at the same time as us, who's turned out to be an incredibly successful person, this guy named Dave Biacelli. Who runs the Billions Corporation, is a very successful booking agent. And of course, Matador, like Gerard had been around for a few years, but like, you know, I think we're the second or third band on Matador and the second band on Drag City after World Trucks. So it was just like, no, there wasn't any of that. And like, I mean, we'd been a band for several years and we did the Lollapalooza thing. The previous year we were supposed to do it. And then, Billy Corgan he was a much bigger deal, so like he wouldn't play if Pavement was on the bill because he's such a
cool guy,
easily sensitive, insecure, strange man.
Is that all because of that lyric, which I noticed you guys didn't, because I went to the Hollywood Bowl show and then noticed the lyric had changed in Range Life.
Is they there... changed every night, you know.
Oh, okay.
And you know, he just does that to entertain himself, songs he's played times and stuff like that. But no, completely. I mean, the guy, it's ridiculous. It's not even worth talking about. And so we ended up doing the Lollapalooza in 95 because it was more like you know, Sonic Youth, we toured with several times in the early part of the 90s. We're friends with them. And Jesus Lizard, you know. So a lot of the bands we knew really well, and we kind of, when we were getting overpaid, I mean, like, it was crazy. And it was the first time we'd really sort of owned the occasional one-off, gotten, like, kind of overpaid. So, and it turned out to be, like, kind of a fail. Like, most of the people, they sort of over it, like, a lot of people, they kind of overestimated our success. Like, payment was really, especially in this country, was never really that big of a deal. Like, we just had, like, really devoted supporters who would, like, in many cases, go see a hit string of shows in a row. I'm sure you've had that in your band, like, people that are just hardcore that go see, like, three or four nights in a row.
Yeah, the people who love us, you know.
Yeah, no, it's great. So it's, your experience is very similar to ours. But then we do, like, we were way bigger in the UK and Europe than here.
Okay.
Which makes sense. I mean, like, obviously, many of our influences, we had more sort of influences in the UK bands from the 70s and 80s than, obviously, like, the early stuff would be, you know, The Fall and Swell Maps and Wire and stuff like that. So, legendary stuff. So, and then, you know, of course, the British in general, they sort of, like, embraced this as their own because they thought that the band was called Pavement because that's sort of what in America they call what we call a sidewalk, they call Pavement.
Mm.
So they just, like, and, you know, we love so many UK bands from the 70s and 80s that were huge influences on us as teenagers. So we were very successful in England and Germany and Holland and, you know, and then did quite well in Australia and Japan, which is fantastic. It was just a wonderful, journey. Like, but at the same time, the US was sort of interesting. Like, some places, like, we wouldn't draw at all. I'm sure you experienced this too.
Yeah. You have your good nights and your off nights and
same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Obviously, like, we were from Stockton. So San Francisco, like, kind of thought that, treated us like a Bay Area band, which was kind of nice. But I remember Gary, when he was in the band, we actually got, I think it was in 90, it was 92, the year Slayton and Shannon came out. It was the only time that Pavement actually won a major music award.
Oh.
Won the BAMMY, which is the Bay Area Grammy, for Best Alternative Album. For Slayton and Shannon, and none of us wanted to go because it just seemed like a brutal thing to do. But, like, Gary wanted to go because he'd never won anything. And he'd been in bands for, like, 27 years. So he and his wife went, and Gary, of course, got bombed because he would drink, like, you know, 20 vodka grapefruits a day, drink, like, a half gallon of vodka a day, and routinely. And I'm afraid he still does. But although I only talk to him once every 3 years, maybe. But so he got bombed, but then so like, and he didn't know he was going to win. He was just like on the nominee. He didn't know any of the other bands. That was one of the great things about Gary. He was always just completely, whereas we knew what was going on. Like, Gary was just completely, he had like no, he thought because like we were on the cover of indie rock magazines that we must be making. He was delusional. Like,
yeah.
You know, he's like, we must be far more successful than we were. But so he would, so they some guy comes up to him like 30 seconds before and says, "Hey, buddy, you won." Okay, and like so then like they announce the award, Best Alternative Rock Record from the Bay Area, even though Stockton is definitely not in the Bay Area. and Gary went, so Gary's got to go up there and he's absolutely bombed. And he's a very small man, and the guy that was giving him the award was the famous saxophone player Clarence Clemens, who's his hands are like massive, and like Gary's and I wish I could have been there to see it, but like Gary was too incoherent to make any speech. He just like held up the trophy. He's obviously bombed. He said, "Thank you very much," and just like walked off the stage. And, like they, you know, his wife had a great night. It was a great night for them because like they, you know, they're just, you know, they live in the middle of nowhere out in Linden, California, outside of Stockton. So went to San Francisco, and Gary came home with some sort of trophy that I've never even seen. You know, it was crazy. But that would be it.
Crazy. Yeah. So. You guys are gonna come back next year, right?
I am.
That was the plan.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of issues with that. I mean, obviously, concerts are in Europe. And yes. Who would, even in January of this year, Ruben, do you think I'd be able to make a statement like this to you? Even yeah. in January and February of this year, Ruben, at some point in your life as an American citizen, your passport is worthless and you'll only be able to go freely enter 4 other countries in the world.
I know.
I mean, it's just mind. So at this point, obviously, the Primavera Sound thing we're supposed to do this year then got pushed back to Labor Day weekend. And I was very concerned about that because I talked to our booking agent and he said, you know, these people are really determined to get this to happen. And I was like, whoa, amazing. So like it might actually happen. This is like, you know, 2 months ago. And he said, yeah, like depending on how they're doing with the COVID-19, it might actually happen. And I said, wow, that's crazy. He said, well, my big concern is that, and he had a tremendous amount of foresight. This might have even been more like 60 to 90 days ago. He said, I'm really concerned that they won't let Americans in.
Mm.
And that, I'm sure, affected their decision that I would say at least half the bill comes from U.S. and U.K. Mm. And does every year, if not more. Yeah. So at this point, if there is a window early in the year next year, then I would say in order to do these two concerts that are currently scheduled in June, that Pavement, if given a window to leave this country for 60 to 90 days, might relocate to Canada or the UK or some part of Europe. So when the time comes, we can access these shows as opposed to sitting here in this country and not being able to leave the country.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'd say that the shows are so important to us, especially postponed 1 year, and we want to do it and ideally sort of move on to the next thing, which if it is a successful venture and we feel good about it, that we may do a bit of touring that's completely undefined the following year. And there is, of course, the qualifier that it needs to be a good experience. So
yeah.
So at this point, yeah, it's very important that for us, I mean, speaking just for us and anybody that cares about Pavement, that we can get out of our country and play these two shows. I mean,
yeah. And when you say a good experience, you know, you guys have been so close for so long. You're kind of like brothers. Is it kind of like that where you guys kind of get on each other's nerves if it's taking too long? Like, you know, but it's all in good love. Like
I think
brothers.
It's Malchus. I think it all comes down. I think really the other four members of Pavement are basically willing to put down whatever they're doing to do Pavement at any time. And cool. And Steven's situation is different. He's got all the different solo projects. He's yes. got the Chicks. He's got, you know, there's always a lot on his plate. So it all really comes down to him and if he wants mm-hmm. to do it. So anybody that sort of thinks like, oh, why doesn't Pavement do more? It's just, we would, but it's just when Steven decides that it's what he wants to do. Because like,
yeah.
whereas Pavement can technically play shows without me or a guy replacing Steve West or whatever. Just like you and Dante Elefante, you know, I'm telling you, a Dante Elefante gig without Ruben is just it's not worth attending. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The same thing can be said instead of Malchus. Like, it's like, whereas you can get any turd back there to pound the skins. Okay. True. So basically you called me and Steve West turds.
You guys are the best turds.
They were nice turds.
Yeah, the best,
very
nicest harm, turds.
Very harmless. who knows? I mean, yeah, so when I use that language, it means hopefully he has a good time, but then he'll want to do more.
Yeah. And when speaking of the turds, the percussion, I started on drums too. That was like the first thing I learned. How much syncing is there, like when you guys are practicing, like, together?
We never practice. We just practice for normally, even in 2010, we probably practiced for about 6 to 8 hours, which is enough because we played the songs. The biggest concern about that year is that when you do these reunion things, like, so basically when you guys do a headlining set, how long do you play? You play like about 15 songs and maybe an encore, like 18, you know?
Yeah, like a 45, 10 hour set.
Mm-hmm. Hours. So if you're the headliner, you play for an hour, then you do like maybe an encore if you want.
If they want it, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Same. So like when Pavement was around, we'd play for 60, 70 minutes. Cause I always made the set list. So
oh, really?
We would play for 60, 70 minutes. And then like if we weren't awful, or even if we were awful, they would usually have us come back out. So then like they could sort of like heckle us or whatever. But, so yeah, but one thing about the reunion situation is that they kind of want it to be like closer to 2 hours long. Ooh. So the big concern was really more. And of course, back then I was in 2010, I was 42 and fitness was the issue. Cause I don't know how many 2 hour shows you played.
But several. Like,
oh really?
Like at breweries, you know?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 I've never really done that before. And like, I'm pretty out of
it
shape
sucks.
In general. Like I'm not a healthy guy. I mean, I'm not unhealthy, but I'm not a
fit. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
they're brutal. They're not fun. They're just kind of like, oh my God, we're still playing.
What you're describing sounds awful, but like,
oh yeah. We're not.
Yeah. Brewery gig. Jesus.
Yeah. Brutal. Like they give you like $200.
Don't you're... stop believing it at Santa Barbara weddings. I don't know how, like, I mean,
it's tough. That's why you like. That's why you have to leave Santa Barbara, which is it's tough.
It's
like,
a lot better than most jobs, but at the same time,
oh
like,
yeah,
it is. There is a demoralizing aspect.
Well, that's why you want to leave Santa Barbara, see what the other scenes are like, and then you come back and you're like, okay, this is a fucking vacation town. Like
I'll
calm down. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You were born there too, right?
I know. Yeah, I was. I'm in the bubble.
Your parents, are they still there? Your parents?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. How often do you see them?
All the time, actually, yeah.
Okay, cool. So, like, that hasn't really affected your 2020 then, like, the...
No, I still see them all the time. My parents are your age. They had kids really young.
Yeah. Yeah. My mother, she's been on lockdown the entire year. She lives in an independent living facility in Richmond, Virginia, and she's 83, and she's doing fine. I talk to her all the time. Very interesting person, extremely progressive minded and always has been, and it's a wonderful person to talk politics with. She's still
nice.
Sharp at 83. I mean, it's incredible, really. But and of course her mind is blown.
Yeah,
just blown. And you know, so it is, her viewpoints are always really interesting and spot on. But she's really razor sharp. But she's one of those people, thank God, that never gets bored. But my sister and her kids, they only live like, they're close, like you are to your parents, only like a handful of miles away. And up until like even like maybe about 30 days ago, for the first time, she was just allowed to go out and see my sister once or twice a week. And she can't do any spend the nights. And like when I go to Richmond, I stay with my mom. My mom's got this awesome, it's this really cool, nice 2-bedroom apartment, you know. And I have
That's
a blast
cool.
when I visit her. And one thing I've noticed about myself personally is that, you know, I'm in my early 50s and I realized that I was completely born out of time when I visit this place in Richmond. It's called Westminster Canterbury. And there's I'd say the average age of the women there is like 85. And I noticed my mother lives on the 8th floor, like going in and out of the place. It's like that the, women in that age group are the first age group that I've ever encountered that sort of find me attractive. So I really sort of enjoy that. Like, I find myself going up and down the elevator, like getting, and I'm just kidding about that aspect, but like women are just like, what a handsome young man. I've never felt that way. So I finally realized that if I was born in like 1937 instead of 1967, which of course would have been impossible because my mother would have won. And I actually would have been like hot, you know, or like,
yeah, totally. Hot.
Instead, I've always just had to adopt the policy, like, you know, I'm not that pathetic, but you know what I mean?
But to go back on,
it's fun. It's fun to
go
get
back
flirted with by 80 year old women.
Yeah.
It's a subject that you probably haven't put much thought into.
I did work at a retirement home once.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and they're very sweet. But I wanted to go back to the set list and playing. So did you make the set list for the reunion shows in 2010?
Yeah. But I keep in mind, like, we only learned how to play, like, 40 songs and have to slap, like, 28 on there a night. So it was rather easy.
Yeah, it was a lot like from Quarantine the Past. the greatest hits.
We just played, there's 40 songs. It was actually like, I think we could have been more adventurous in our choices. And I think that next year's shows will be sort of similar to that vibe because they're whatever, big festival gigs.
Big shows, yeah.
And, but I'd say if we do some stuff beyond that, that we would definitely make it quite a bit more adventurous and not put pavement enthusiasts through having to hear the 1100th rendition of like Cut Your Hair.
Yeah, so, totally.
Although, you know, you never know. I mean, like, who knows? I mean, it's basically whatever they want to play. But I think it would be really great to actually play. There's at least 20 songs, pavement songs that I got to let the dog in that we never played live because we tried to play them live and the versions were so awful. So I think we should sort of embrace that challenge to at least have like a half dozen songs on the list that we've never played before live. Hold on. Yeah. I'll show you the chord.
Okay.
Bye, guys. Let me show him to you, Ruben. He's quite an individual. He's just about to turn 7, this guy.
Oh, so sweet.
Yeah, that's Mr. Ghost.
Oh, nice. So yeah, cute.
He's a great dog.
How old is he?
He's he'll be 7 in October.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's a cardigan Welsh corgis. Most people come up to me and they're like, that's not a corgi. And I'm like, yeah, it is.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
They're familiar with the Pembroke, and like the cardigans have tails and they're bushier and they're bigger. He's a very big corgi.
Oh, that's awesome.
Big ego, massive ego. His life is an eternal search for comfort and he's winning.
Yeah, that's also my search for eternal comfort.
It could have something to do with the fact that we've spoiled our four-legged children.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool, pulling out some deep cuts, but I still think there will be people who want to hear Cut Your Hair, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it kind of depends, but like, you know?
That balance of the hits and the deep cuts.
Yeah, I think there's both. I think there's people that want to hear deep cuts.
Yep.
They want to be there the first time that we sort of like completely destroy any number of pavement songs we've never played live.
And yeah,
I imagine that it could be quite risky. But some songs are just terrible live. Like Carrot Rope was awful live.
I was just about to bring that up. That was actually the first pavement song I heard, and I worked my way backwards.
About that. I never really liked it very often. I never liked that. I never really liked Rattled by the Rush.
Oh, I remember Steven dedicated that one to Matt Leinart at the Hollywood Bowl.
That was appropriate.
2010,
I forgot about Matt Leinart.
I was the only one laughing at that joke. I was like, oh, yeah, I don't think a lot of people watch football in this audience.
The only time I ever met Matt Leinart was at some weird alternative rock event. I tried to use his head as the cue ball, and I then I realized that it was way too big for that. But I wonder how the old Leinart Meister is doing these days.
I don't know. A lot of those USC quarterbacks, really, like Matt Barkley, Leinart.
Leinart's doing great. He's doing great. I'm sure he's some analyst. He's just an analyst.
Yeah, probably. Are you guys all San Francisco 49er fans, being from Stockton?
Rattled by the Rush, man. See, he's really clever. The Niners. No, I don't think anybody roots for the Niners. I don't think really anybody has a favorite NFL team.
Mm.
I think that Steven is a really, really good and competitive fantasy sports person.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's particularly good at the NBA and baseball. And I think of course, there's been this renaissance of Virginia college basketball that we're
enjoying. Yeah.
And we're huge fans of that. Just me and Steve. And Steve West doesn't care at all about sports. Hamburg is a huge Oakland A's fan.
Okay.
Because of Stockton.
Yeah.
And he's very Stockton. He's the most, he's not there now, but like he is the Stockton. His parents had like the original address on the back of like our early records, and like they dealt with
That's
all the
awesome.
And stuff. And Yeah, but Malkus is one of those guys that kind of roots for like different teams every year based on like who he thinks is cool on the team. But I'd say his strongest opinions would be of NBA players. He's a very he's a big NBA enthusiast. He loves the NBA. And he's one of his best friends, or one of his good friends, is this guy who writes for the NBA. But he used to write for Roto World, that fantasy sports website. Obviously, I'm speaking Greek to you now.
No, that's fine. I love sports. That's what I looked up.
What are your teams? What are your teams?
I like the Dallas Cowboys.
Okay. I used to be a Raiders fan, but then when they moved to LA, that put me off when I was a kid. Yeah. Back in like the Marv Hubbard and the Mark Van Egan era, because they both went, my dad was a football star at Colgate, and both of those guys went to Colgate. And you know, they had so much character, those Oakland Raiders teams. And totally. You know, I mean, there's times that if I had to say my favorite NFL team right now by far is the Tennessee Titans, because I some of my friends are season ticket holders, and they're just great. Actually, the drummer for Silver Jews, Brian Kotzer, who's actually in this really cool band now that just put out a good record on Fat Possum called Country Westerns. And Kotzer is like one of the biggest Titans fans of all time. And one of my oldest friends, a comedian named Kevin Guthrie, is an artist now. Like visual art. He does like pastels of athletes on 12 pack beer cartons. It's actually pretty interesting. He actually does well, and he's good. They're sick Titans fans. I like the Titans. I tend to root for teams that my friends, just to make them happy, but I do actually like the Titans. I was excited by their...
Yeah, they gave a shout-out to David, didn't they?
Yeah, they lost to the Chiefs. They were ahead at halftime.
Yeah.
And then reality set in. But I grew up a Knicks fan, so it's very painful, that aspect. I do love, I'm a huge Malcolm Brogdon fan. I was very disappointed when he got traded from the Milwaukee Bucks to the Indiana Pacers. Although I like the Pacers fine, it's just that I don't think I'd like to be amongst their fans.
Have you watched any of these games in the bubble?
I can't watch the bubble because, I guess I'll probably, when it gets down to the finals or stuff, I'll tune in. But the main reason is I just can't. I've been a basketball fan for so long, mostly of college and also the NBA. Okay. And I just, the only basketball I can possibly handle in the summertime would be like a good Olympic. Like it just doesn't make sense in the summertime to me. It seems like summer league. It just doesn't.
Yeah. But with no fans in the audience, it really does look like summer league.
Yeah. And the fact that there's never a fresh start. You know, like you can't just pick up where you were in a season. So like the only thing that's really working for me right now is the usual and the mainstay, which is UK and Irish racing, horse racing, which I
got it. Yeah. Yeah. Cause they didn't really stop horse racing.
They stopped for like 60, 90 days. US racing didn't stop.
Okay.
But keep in mind, the state I live in, the state of Iowa, never stopped either.
Because you can gamble in Iowa.
Well, our governor's a woman named Kim Reynolds who's up Trump's skirt.
Oh, I see.
So Iowa never shut down.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sports gambling. Wait, what happened?
It's pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
But yeah, so... baseball. I hope that baseball, since it's not bubbled and there's, a different outbreak story every day. I'm a lifelong hardcore Pittsburgh Pirates fan. And I was
go Pirates.
I think that we'll be all out to win 10 out of 60 games. I think that what we're doing is using this 60 game season to sort of test out 40 or 50 guys that play for the Pirates, sort of figure out their worth going forward during like a real. So I think we are in that category of teams like the Royals and the Tigers and a few other teams that figured there's no way they're going to make the top 16. Yeah. So let's just like use this as like, since baseball is real now, it's not spring training, we use this sort of as a testing ground for all of our arms and all of our young players, especially, and then the veterans to figure out in the off season. It'd be very interesting for me to see, like, if there is an 162 game season next year, I'd like to think that there will be, and that all the baseball before the All-Star break will be played in a similar fashion as this. Then hopefully later in the year after the All-Star break, the fans will return, which will make for just, it'll just be so great for baseball fans.
Totally.
And, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, the 60-game season doesn't bother me if they can pull it off, because it's just that it's a fresh – it's a different thing. So I will actually – whoever wins the World Series this year, I will actually call a World Series winner, because it's just a different kind of competition. It's like a condensed 60 games. It's like a different – it's like a – it's a baseball tournament from day one. I just think it's pretty fascinating, and it just makes sense to me in the summertime. Just like, you know, horse racing is a year round thing, and most, it's marginalized. Most people don't really care about that. I give a hoot about car racing. Can't stand it.
Yeah.
And then hockey, like one of my best friends, Gary Smith, played, in the NHL. He's 76 now, played in the NHL for 18 years. He was a fantastic goalie for, his nickname was Suitcase, because he played for so many different teams. He got traded a lot. So it's fun to like watch hockey with him. But I don't really watch hockey on a regular basis.
Totally. Anymore. I got into hockey for a little bit. I was like, oh, this is awesome. And the Kings were really the Kings.
Yeah, they were
winning.
Good for a while, yeah.
I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe this is – maybe I like hockey now. And that just fell off.
Yeah, do you have a favorite baseball team?
No, baseball's the one I never got into. It's mostly football. I played football in high school. And then,
oh, you did?
Yeah.
You did, yeah.
Yeah, and then basketball too, but I don't really have an allegiance to a team in basketball. I like the Lakers. My dad's a Bulls fan, so maybe I'll watch a game with him, you know.
They're too, yeah, they're pretty bad.
Yeah, there's a little bit of hope with
Lakers,
Derrick Rose.
I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, I think they're probably how could they not win at all? But you never know. I mean, like, there's a handful of good teams in the league. It's just so unusual. It just doesn't make, to me, it's like a complete throwout. Whatever they do, I just hope nobody gets like a career-ending injury and nobody gets a bad case of COVID-19. Because the thing is, like with NBA players in particular, is that I think by nature, a lot of the athletes in the NBA, even though we think of them as the world's greatest athlete, is that a lot of them, for lack of a better term, are you know, freakishly talented athletes. And like, you know, you hear all the every not a year goes by, and especially in the NBA or college sports, where like a lot of these guys have unusual heart conditions, premature heart conditions, and things like that. So they're, whereas we think of them as just these incredible athletes who like can just do such a mind-blowing things with their bodies on the basketball court, there's a certain amount of susceptibility in being like 6'11".
Yeah, 6'11". Yeah.
Exactly. I'm just like the way your body's made, like, it sort of makes sense, like, if there's a certain amount of logic to it. So, obviously, none of these people, especially when they really kick it up a gear and start trying really hard, that they get hurt. That would be a shame and sort of like a throwout NBA season. But also, like, some, you know, the thing that terrifies me the most about COVID-19, in addition to being a diabetic and the fact that if I get a bad case of it, I definitely die, is that one thing we're not talking about, because we're very much in the present with COVID-19, is the people, whether they be your age or my age or older or younger, in fact, that have a bad case of COVID-19 that they survive significantly affect their lives. And we haven't really talked, we don't really know, there is much of a discussion in this country on the out-of-pocket expense of people that get a bad case of COVID-19. And yeah. I'm surprised that hasn't been on like 60 Minutes or something like that. Like, you know, she was on a vent for 8 days and now she has to go through 11 months of physical rehab. Here's the bill for Sandra from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. You know what I mean? Like, the expenses has to be almighty. And like,
I saw something on Twitter. This guy had to pay like $4 million and he was in there for
crazy.
A week on a ventilator.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's just crazy. So like, who knows? I mean, I'm not going to get there. I mean, like, there's no need to really get overtly political, but you know, really, I've been
totally
November 3rd is just going to be quite a day. And what happens afterwards? I mean, like, if a guy like Biden, he becomes the president, what he's going to inherit is just going to be so mind blowing. I mean, like, I mean, talk about a bad position to be in. It's going to be the worst office to inherit in history. That we're completely unaware of 99% of the damage that's been done.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
I mean, God knows. I mean, like, so, I mean, it's fairly obvious that I want the incumbent out. But at the same time, like, it might be pretty easy to get the next guy out or for the GOP to win whatever they want back, because there's going to be, it'll be quite easy to blame what's going on in the country on the current administration. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, this administration economically rode the coattails of a successful economy and took credit for it. Now they've completely destroyed this economy. Destroyed this, could be destroyed for like decades.
Yeah.
All because of like the main reason being would be out of fear of the Dow Jones Industrial Average being affected by a global pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, how poison is that? Like, where, like, how far have we gone in the greed department? I mean, like, it's just nuts. But that's enough about that. Everybody knows where I stand, Dante. But anyways, I guess I kind of have to wrap it up here because
Okay, cool.
I got to make dinner. But yeah, any other? Obviously, I've taken up a lot of your time by interviewing. You've been really, really great. It's been really great to have you on your show.
No, yeah. Thank you, man. Thank you. I have a couple questions, but you know what? We answered most of them in a natural way where I didn't have to set up. I've realized that with a lot of musicians, like, I think it's the way we get interviewed typically. They kind of just look at you like, you got another question, but you've done such a good job at just like talking. I'm like, oh, thank God. He likes to talk. Oh, thank God.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, like, you talk to a lot of musicians. I'm not a musician. I'm a dude who was in a band.
Yeah, that's true.
Very lucky. Like, of all the people in the world, if you'd known me when I was 21 and you'd see me at like 60, we were the same age. You saw me at every show that you went to, and you'd be like, oh, there, the guy's great. Like, you know, he's always at all the shows, and, you know, buys merch, he buys records like that. You would be like, I never thought that guy would be in a band. I'm that guy. Like, you know, it's like, I'm that guy that just, and I think that I did a good job. But it's just so, like, to my parents, we're just like, you're in a what? Like, you're going to England to play shows? Like, we've never seen you play music in your life, you know, other than records, you know, like. Yeah. So that was a huge challenge. But I relished it. I loved it. And I get to, it was so exciting for me, but a lot of it was just like total nervous energy, you know.
Yeah.
And fear.
Well, I'll leave you with one final moment here. When I was overly refreshed once, I got a pavement tattoo.
Oh, no way. What is that?
It says pavement.
Oh, cool. Yeah, fantastic.
I was very overly refreshed.
Yeah, pleasure to talk to you about, you know, pavement. Yeah, man.
It was awesome.
It was a wonderful experience, and I look forward to doing it again, and hopefully you said you saw us at the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh yeah, and I'll come to the next show whenever it happens.
Yeah, we'll let you know. And you know, don't pay some exorbitant ticket price, just shoot me an email, and I'll get you and at least you in.
Oh yeah, I'll take it.
Sometimes like big cities like that, it's like, you know, it's hard to get the plus one thing, you
yeah
know?
Totally.
You know, because you got to put like all kinds of like your late, whatever, however it works. Like,
yeah, the people got
to. Becomes this thing. It's like, so then you look around your backstage and there's all these people that somebody in the know is telling you that's on like a TV show. And you're like, well, what are they doing at a pavement show? And it's like, oh, their publicist told them to show up just to take, you know, for photo ops.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah. It's like,
I'm like, okay, like, so they're. It's weird, but yeah, I will say this. There is one. I'm sure. I don't know if you're aware of it. You probably are as a sports fan and as an NFL. Yeah. Are you aware of Mina Kimes?
Oh no.
You know Mina Kimes, the ESPN. She does the NFL stuff for ESPN.
Oh, maybe if I saw her face, I know their faces really well.
So she lives like not far from you. She lives somewhere in LA.
Oh, cool.
A bunch of broker's tip stuff. Oh, by the way, if you do want to check out my record label, we're putting out new releases. We've got a band from a really great band from San Francisco called C Night, and we're putting out a band from Baltimore I like called Quattro Senta. And then we're putting out this buddy of mine, MG Clark, who makes really kind of weird instrumental stuff from Denver. Cool. And then the Australian pop star Holiday Sidewinder. We're putting out
awesome.
Her. That's coming out before the end of the year. The
first all their 7 inches?
And you can get it all. Yep. All 7 inches and brokerstiprecords.com. And we've got t-shirts now and a few hats. And before I put out, when I'm done this year, I think it'll be 10 records in the last like 3 or 4 years. So I like to do like a clip of 2 or 3 a year. And like people send me stuff and I find it very hard to say no, but I have to. And like generally the way it works is that I meet the people and I sort of approach them and ask them to hear their music, you know? So, but it's fun. It's tiny. You know, I mean, like I just went to the post office and sent off 8 packages. Like we're lucky to get like in a great week, we get like 3 or 4 orders a week, you know? And we do a lot of international business, which is cool. But the website just started. It's been really fun. It's just nice. It's fun to do. I really enjoy it. So yeah, check us out at Broker's Tip. Let me show you your shirt. Yeah, there's our shirt and our logo.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I'll mail you one of these actually.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Do you like that lime on maroon? I like that lime on maroon.
Yeah, I like it. It's cool.
Yeah, and kind of, you can't tell whether it's a record store or a record label. I should probably put the website on there. These are the marketing things.
No, people.
From Ruben from Dante Elefante. No. So, anyways, great talking to you, man. I look forward to meeting you in person, man. Thanks for getting in touch with me. And I'll be happy whenever you're one of those. I live in Des Moines, you know. I work, you know, but I usually work 70 hours a week, and this year I'm only working 25 hours a week. So if you're in one of those situations where you have a guest canceled, then shoot me a text. Maybe I'll come on.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to you about, soups and stews or growing tomatoes or, you know, dog walking or whatever. But anyways, have a great night, bud.
Hey, man. I'll see you soon.
Yeah, good luck with everything, man.
Thanks, man.
Let me know if you need anything.
Okay, I will. Thanks, man.
Have a great night, brother.
You too.